Let me ask you, where are the jobs of the future? We've seen a huge technological revolution. We've seen computers, we've seen robotics, we've seen jobs that are lost as a result of this new kind of technological revolution that's taken place. Where are those jobs of the future going to be, Michael?
Well, first of all, I think they're going to be in many swaths of the economy, some of which we can't predict. If you talk about where they're going to be 20 years from now or 30 years from now, go back 20 or 30 years. Go back to 1980 when everybody was talking about when the income distribution was more equal, the earnings premium has risen since then, the inequality has increased. Think of all the things that have happened since that you would have said, Michael must be off his meds if I had predicted in 1980. We had a second oil crisis. Would you believe that 3D seismic imaging and then fracking would free us largely from the power of OPEC? The personal computer had just been invented. Deng Xiaoping had just started opening up China. The Berlin Wall wouldn't fall for another 9 years. It was still widely debated whether we were all going to converge on a social welfare state somewhere to the left of Sweden, communists rounding off some of their rough edges, et cetera. And except on some college campuses, at Stanford as well as Berkeley, communism has basically collapsed as a central organizing principle for an economy and polity, thank goodness, for all the misery it wrought. So there are a lot of things, and women, we talked about, Christy mentioned the rise of female labor force, it was just beginning. If we'd have said that women would be a majority of college graduates in a generation, you would have said you're nuts. So I think it's kind of hard to predict. There are a few basic large forces we know will be operative for a long time, like demography. So the things that are involved in healthcare, medicine, biosciences, doing those sorts of things. Technology is not going to get less important, it'll get more important. How much more important will depend on a lot of things. How long Moore's law, the chip performance doubling every 18 months, has to run. The pessimists say it's getting more expensive. It costs Intel $6 billion to build a fab now. The optimists will say, well, we can make three-dimensional chips now, and we can use software to distribute loads among chips. So there's fundamental science and engineering, some of which will be the part I agree with about the investment in basic sciences on public money. We doubled the budget of the NSF when I was CEA chairman in a very, very difficult budget environment. Well, we used to think we had large budget deficits back then, Leon. It's kind of a joke now. But so all those things suggest that if you're looking at a report from some bureaucrat in the BLS saying there's where the jobs are going to be, calculating this to the third significant figure to this many thousands of jobs, it's very likely to be off. So I think that it's going to be in lots of places. I think we're going to have a demand for energy. We're going to have to reconcile our energy needs, economic growth, and environmental concerns. So while I think that it's the pace at which that's going to happen has been greatly exaggerated by people who want to force feed it, it's happening slowly. There will be those kinds of jobs, and alternative energy will eventually grow to significance. Right now, they're very small relative to, say, fracking jobs. So there are a variety of things of that sort, and something I know Bob has written a lot about and I strongly support is a technical training for people repairing and making stuff. He's a big advocate, and I support this, and generically, we might have difference in how we do it. Apprenticeship programs, junior college programs that train people for productive jobs that are likely to be, as you say, repairing and maintaining stuff and so on. But I'll turn it over to them.
Jobs, Bob.
I would say I agree with Michael. It's very hard to predict particular sectors, particular kinds of jobs. But I think that there are basically three broad types of work we're going to see in the future. The first I would call kind of creative, innovative jobs. These are problem solving. You probably need a lot of education and the right connections. You're going to make quite a lot of money. You're going to be innovative not only in high tech, but in finance, in medicine, wherever, really right across the board. We need more innovation. The second category of jobs that people don't really think enough about, and Michael alluded to, are, I call them technician jobs. These are the jobs of people who know a lot of about a particular domain of technology so that they can install, repair, upgrade, maintain. We're becoming intensively software-driven, technologically driven, but we don't have enough people who actually know how to do this stuff. And we don't have, in this country, a good enough technical education kind of path for a lot of people. We have this conceit that everybody, in order to join the middle class, every kid has got to have a four-year college degree. That's a conceit. I think we really do have to establish a world-class system of technical education. Again, we once had that. And then thirdly, everyone else is going to be in the personal service sector. And by that I mean retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, surface transportation, child care, elder care, you know, all of the occupations that require direct connection, one-on-one, attention. They don't pay very well. Just in summary, it's not that we're going to have too few jobs. We'll have enough jobs. The real problem is that most of those jobs, given where we're heading, are not going to pay very well. And that's they're going to be in personal service. And that's going to create a huge problem. It's already slowing down wage growth.
Yeah, I was listening to Michael, and it brought to mind, when I was CEA chair, I was on a mission to China, and I was meeting with a group of Chinese academics, and they said almost your same question, except they said, what's your next industry? Where's America's next industry? They were really quite shocked when I said, I don't know. And it's not my job to know, right? That in a market economy, I'm going to be less good at guessing what the next big growth industry is than the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley or Detroit or wherever. But one of the things, and certainly when we had a group of students here this afternoon, I think one of the biggest lessons for them is flexibility. One of the things we do know is the era where you go to college, you get a job, and you stay in that job for the rest of your career, those are almost surely over. And the numbers are that the chances are most people will reinvent themselves many times. And so certainly as an educator, one of the things I think a lot about is how do you give people the skills that'll let them reinvent themselves, because we don't know what industry they need are going to be doing things in. So is it creativity? Is it personal communication? Is it being able to write? Is it technical skills? But I think that is where we need to focus. And then if I were to guess, you know, one of the things I certainly remember fighting against, there is a sort of notion out there that, you know, the good old days when America made stuff, right? Where stuff was a washing machine, or it was a car, it was something you could see. And I think we shouldn't be ashamed of the fact that as an economy, we are moving more towards services. Services are valuable too. There are good things to produce, whether there's architecture, medicine, finance. Those are admirable, education, those are admirable things. And I think we will be doing more of those as time goes on. That's where America seems to have a comparative advantage. And so again, that's fine, and we just need to make sure we train our kids to do those jobs.
Alan, where are those jobs?
Well, I what I find is that their young people want a job, but they don't want to work. And a job, whether you're haying, and I did that, or bartending, or whatever I did, I had to work. And I worked on a road crew, and I was a tamper, you know, brilliant, you know. And, but I worked, and I got paid. But nowadays, they'll take a job. It's listed, their job openings every day on KODI Cody, 180 of them. Nobody's taking them because they involve effort, and they involve work, and it may be demeaning work. You know, that's the worst kind. When your buddies at night and you're drinking the suds, say, what'd you do today? Well, I cleaned toilets down at the Walmart. That isn't going to get you any kind of peer group approval. But let me tell you, there are jobs, nobody knows what this is. I watched Michigan go down the tubes and Indiana on the ropes, and Wyoming is rolling. They've got a thing called the Jonah Field, huge, huge. The Bakken in North Dakota, another huge, people left Michigan and came to those areas. They lived in man camps. Their families were back home. Not a good situation. Lots of problems in that situation. But then now the oil went back down like it always does, boom and bust. And they moved on to somewhere. And they're moving by themselves waiting to get something, and they're ready to work. You work in the oil patch and you work. And now they're waiting to find something so they can get join with their families. But the business of the job report, and then remember the guy who was a middle management guy, 55 years old, and he lost his job in this great experience. And now he'd like to do something, but when he went to sign up, the guy in front of him had three smartphones sticking out of his pocket and a computer dangling from his hip pocket, and this guy doesn't even know how to turn them on. And he's never going to get back in. And that's the saddest part of all, but I don't know the answer, but I think there's a better way to talk about jobs. There are plenty of jobs out there, but nobody wants them. And really? I'm not saying, look, Erskine and I never touched SSI, we never touched anything in the welfare, we never touched food stamps. People say, well, you guys were pretty tough. I said, don't give me that crap. We didn't touch that stuff. We weren't doing that. Read the 67-page report. And it's just a sad situation where people aren't, they just aren't responding.
Let me mention another area before we go into our break. The whole issue of globalization. We're living in a world now that is interconnected by the internet, by communications, by finance, by trade. And globalization obviously has played a role in some of the job losses mm-hmm. that have taken place. Well, that now is part of a debate in Washington with regards to trade agreements. That are being negotiated by the president. There's the TTP agreement. I think that involves 11 Asian countries in the Pacific Rim and would obviously open up marketplaces in that part of the world. There's another trade agreement with the countries in Europe. And I think we're talking about over 40 countries that would be involved in both of these trade agreements. The president is trying to get fast-track authority from the Congress, which would allow these agreements to be able to be voted on without amendment, which is something that has happened in recent history. And interestingly enough, he's working with Republicans, got some Democratic support, but Democrats are opposed because they're concerned about the issue of job losses, they're concerned about the impact on labor issues, et cetera. On the other hand, the argument for trade is that, as the president has said, is that it can produce additional jobs and help our economy and get us involved in trade, particularly in Asia, with China dominating so much of that marketplace. Who's right on that issue?
I think on balance, the president's right. I think trade is a positive-sum game. Think of when you trade something with a friend. By definition, you wouldn't do it unless you're at least as well off. So both people tend to be better off. Same with trade among nations. It's also true that that's an aggregate of the whole country, and there are losers as well as winners. And we have procedures to try to cushion the losses to the losers, trade adjustment assistance, other types of programs and the like. But they're imperfect. And so our political process, you talked about it being dysfunctional, it's organized other than at the president and vice president level, by local area, by congressional district, or by state. And textiles are very powerful in the Carolinas, which is why it took us a long time to get rid of all the quotas in textiles, et cetera. And you can go on and on, state by state. So those interests get represented locally, and they oppose anything that might be a transition cost to them. And that has to be overcome by the general benefits and any adjustment program. So I think the president has the better of the argument intellectually, but both parties have their protectionists. So we have the Buchanan wing of the Republican Party, and you have a large protectionist, largely environmentalist, labor union wing of the Democratic Party. And so I think it will be an issue whether the president gets trade promotion authority. I hope he does. I think there's probably 51-49 he will with a lot of work. But it's important to understand what's going on. Leon mentioned that it's not a trade deal you're approving, it's the authority of the president to negotiate it and then present it to Congress for an up or down vote. The reason that's important is nobody else will negotiate fully with us. They're not going to do the same thing we have to do, which is promote our interests and occasionally have to recognize we're going to harm some sector or some group in our society and try to deal with it later. And they're not going to put their best offer on the table if they know our Congress can come along and amend it. So I think the appropriate thing to do politically and the appropriate thing to do for the benefit of our country is to give the President and the U.S. Trade Representative authority to negotiate a final deal, and then it should be carefully examined and we should vote. I think if they do their jobs right, a negotiation can produce trade agreements which will stand up to this test of, on balance, it being worthwhile, and the rough edges can be rounded off for people who are hurt.
Bob, you have a different view.
Well, I have a different view because of the context right now. I mean, we've been talking here about inequality, about raging inequality. I mean, one thing that we didn't even put on the table is that since 2009, the start of the recovery, 95% of the economic gains have gone to the top 5%. Most people have seen no wage gains at all. Many people are struggling, even at this stage of the recovery. You have a minimum wage that is 25% below what it was in 1968, adjusted for inflation. You have almost no investment that is really on the ground, running and up for most people in terms of workplace and job retraining and upskilling. You don't have an educational system that, in terms of public higher education, we talked about that, it's getting more expensive and more elusive for so many families. You have almost no investment in infrastructure in terms of all the deferred maintenance, so you have a lot of people that can't get houses that are near their jobs. So look at the large picture of what's happening in the middle class, the old working class, and the poor, and then you look at trade. And we know that the gains from trade outweigh the losses. The winners could compensate the losers and still come out ahead. But they never do. That's the problem. The winners from trade tend to be upper-income people with very well-educated people. The losers tend to be working-class people, lose their jobs, lose their manufacturing jobs. And trade adjustment assistance, Michael, doesn't work. It's too limited. It's too narrow-gauged. So I would say, unless we have a context, unless we have policies that actually are designed to lift people up and share the gains from trade, we're just going to exacerbate inequality even more, exacerbate social tensions, shrink the middle class even further. One other thing I need to be put on the table. The Trans-Pacific Partnership has within it an investment device, a kind of a jurisdictional device that allows any global company to challenge the health, safety, environmental, and labor regulations of any country as somehow interfering in their profits, and allows those companies to get reimbursed by the countries for any health, safety, environmental, or labor regulations that inhibit their profits. Right now, we've got cigarette companies, tobacco companies all over the world who are challenging health programs, anti-smoking programs in developing nations under exactly the same provision. Most people don't know about this. I'm frankly concerned that this was engineered by a handful of big companies, and it's going to make it harder to do the kind of health, safety, environmental, and labor protections we need.
Christy, let me get your view, and then I'll go into the break. Go ahead.
Okay. I mean, I think the big picture is, though, I mean, I don't think trade agreements are going to have that much of an effect on jobs. It's, in fact, we're a pretty low trade barrier country in general. We have pretty open borders for goods and services. And so when we negotiate a trade deal, most often or most of the time what we're doing is leveling the playing field by getting other countries to lower some of their barriers. So I think we it's easy to overstate sort of how much of a change it may have. I also want to, it is true that the globalization has tended to help high-skilled workers because there are a lot more lower-skilled workers throughout the world. But, you know, poor people do buy things, right? And one of the things that trade does is lower prices for a lot of the things. So, you know, there's a reason why, you know, clothing, I notice, is a lot less expensive than it was 20 years ago, and some of that is because of trade, and that is something that kind of everybody buys. So we don't want to lose the gains are perhaps more widely shared than you might have realized. The last piece I'll throw into this, I think a big part, and this is something you mentioned, Leon, I think a lot of these trade deals are much less about economics and much more about foreign policy. It is wanting to be friends with the other countries of Asia. It's wanting to strengthen our ties with Europe. And I think if you think of them more as a security policy, a foreign policy, a making sure that we have a presence in Asia and we're all on the same team, I think that may give you some sense of why the president is fighting so hard for this, not just for the economic side, but also for the foreign policy side.
It'd be a lot easier for that if he allowed natural gas to be exported and helped the Europeans get off of Russian gas. That would dominate anything in the trade agreements.
Alan, for or against the trade agreements?
Well, I've always supported them. I worked with Lloyd Benson, Senator Benson. You know how he worked on that. It's very bipartisan, the NAFTA. I don't think it's been bad. You can bring up a horror story on anything at all. That's the key to Washington, by using emotion, fear, guilt, or racism to do it. That's critical, that you use emotion, fear, guilt, or racism to pass or kill a bill. And now you've got a dollar that's strong, and guess what's happening? It's hurting exports. I mean, when are you going to figure that just do it? Because if you do it, you're going to get all the things that Christine is talking about. And if you're worried about human rights over in another country, they read and write what's going on in Baltimore. They're not listening very well. That's where they hit you back. It's crude and it's not true, but all they do is dig that up and say, you're giving us lectures on human rights, and I've seen Ferguson on television, I've seen Baltimore, I've seen this guy. And so don't give us that. And then environment, what's the worst environment to have people here who don't have jobs? The best human right is a job. There is no thing better for a human being than a job.
All right, thank you.
You're cutting me off, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, if you have something worthwhile.
No, I don't have it. I just started to rant. I was ranting.
It was such a good line.
It was a good line.
I had a good line. What do you think?
I enjoy
line?
Your rants, Alan. Right. I really do.
That tough one.
You know, we used to escape from our offices when I was Secretary of Labor, and Alan was a senator, and my staff said, "Don't have lunch with that Republican right-wing fascist." And what did your staff say to you?
My staff said, "You're going to have lunch with Bob Reich, that commie over there in the Labor." I said, "Yeah, we like each
other." We snuck out.
Sneak.
I mean, it was like having an illicit affair. And I'd meet Alan, and we'd go, "Shh, don't tell me." It's worse, Alan. It's worse now in Washington.
These guys had a television show that was called The Long and the Short of It.
Alan, stand up for a second.
Wait a minute.
We embody inequality.
It's true.
Whoop. All right, I'd like to take a moment now to recognize our question review team, the people responsible for selecting the questions that we're going to be asking in the second part of the program, and I'd ask you to hold their applause until I introduce all of them. First, Julie Copeland, who's the city editor of the Santa Cruz Sentinel, Fran Gaver, who's an attorney with Leach & Walker and also a veteran member of our question review team, Doug McKnight, who's a reporter for KAZU Radio, Don Miller, who's executive editor of the Monterey Herald and the Santa Cruz Sentinel, and Pete Wiversky, who is the executive editor of the Salinas Californian. If you would thank them, please. We also have a group of students that are representing those who attended the afternoon student program. We have a great afternoon program that involves students from all over the Central Coast.
And I would like to ask those students that are here to please stand up, and please remain standing until I read the schools that you're representing. The schools are the Defense Language Institute, the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, the Navy Postgraduate School, and the University of California at Santa Cruz. Thank you very much. All right. We had a wonderful turnout of students this afternoon. I think we had a great program. I think the speakers enjoyed the opportunity to talk with young people. The program is made possible because of the generous support of our lecture series sponsors. And Sylvia and I, along with the board of directors of the Panetta Institute, are very grateful for that sponsorship. It allows these students from high schools, from colleges, universities, or military installations from throughout the Central Coast to be able to come here and participate and listen to our speakers. So I would appreciate it if you would give our sponsors a hand.